great to have you back with us at GoldSeek.com Radio. Today's featured guest, Charles Hughes Smith from Of Two Minds. We've got a special guest. It's just a pleasure to welcome Charles Hughes Smith of the blog Of Two Minds, and of course his 10th year anniversary. Covers a wide spectrum of topics, including housing, Asia, energy, all kinds of trends and themes throughout the market, social issues. He's written 7 must-read books of his own. Welcome, sir.
Thank you very much, Chris. A little bit humbled by your description.
No, you shouldn't. I noticed lately health is a very important topic and issue that you've been concerned with. Many of our listeners, like myself, spend, it seems like, endless hours in front of a computer screen. It's not healthy. Recently, last 6 months, I've been every hour getting up, walking around minimum 5 or 10 minutes briskly. This is supposed to be a wonder cure, and it certainly had big impact on my life. Give us an idea of how health care is an issue impacting everybody.
Well, Chris, I applaud you for breaking up your sit-down time, and I try to do the same thing. I mean, recent studies have said sitting for many hours in a row is just really bad news for us. And, of course, the reason why is we weren't really developed as hunter-gatherers and, you know, small agricultural communities where we came from. Sitting down for hours on end in a chair was not something we did. So our comfort in our modern society is actually a health risk. And so I think my interest in health is both as a citizen, if you will, and it's as a consumer of health care. I'm self-employed, so my wife and I pay our own health care insurance costs. We make too much money to have it subsidized. We're not rich enough so that it doesn't count. It does count. It's $15,000 a year for 2 people. And so I think that's where I start from, is what kind of care are we getting for the amount of money that we spend? And we spend about twice as much per person in the U.S. As our competitor nations like Japan, Germany, and the rest of Western Europe, our developed country competitors. And so you have to wonder, what are we doing wrong that we're spending twice as much money, but we're not twice as healthy? And, of course, it's a complicated topic, but in general, it's the same problem that all of our major industries have, which is if you get enough money, then you can buy political influence and protect your industry from competition and transparency. And that's healthcare all over it, right? We all know the billing system is really opaque. You can't figure out what the bill is. You know, we know that they bill Medicare huge amounts of money and then they settle for less, but it's still way more than it should be. So all these problems are facing us as individuals and also as a society, and the demographics are really running against us here because, I'm 61 and like there's 60 million of us baby boomers, and we're entering the system here, which was designed for an older time when there was people didn't live as long and there was maybe 5 to 8 workers per retiree. Well, now it's going to be pushing 2 to 1. There'll only be 2 full-time workers for every retiree, and I don't think any system is sustainable at that that ratio.
I've enjoyed over the years your comments and commentary on the housing sector. 2007, 2008, we saw everything come unraveled at the seams. Since then, things have started to recover, at least on paper. I'd like your thoughts on whether or not you expect this echo bubble, as you call it, to persist, or if this is merely a blip on the radar screen.
Well, that's a great question, Chris, and a lot of us are wondering that ourselves, and it's hard to predict, but we can at least look at the fundamental dynamics here. One is the tremendous range in valuations we have here in the United States. Like, I have a reader in Columbus, Ohio, for Midwest, former industrialized, you know, area that's kind of coming to grips with that passing of that industrialized area. And some of the cities are doing very well, some less well. But in general, you can still buy a house there for, $60,000, or even if it's in a troubled area, $20,000, $6,000. I mean, you can buy a house or you can rent a house for $800, where here on the left coast in the urbanized California areas, no young person or young couple, even earning good salaries, can possibly afford an $800,000 2-bedroom, 1-bath bungalow. It's just ridiculous. And so the danger is we've priced out the younger generation entirely. in these hyper developed markets like Greater New York, some of Miami, California, LA, so on, and those are where the job growth and the salaries are strong, and so I think we're facing a social inequality issue here. That those of us who bought 20, 30 years ago, we've increased our wealth at least on paper, where the young generation has been priced out, and so that's an issue that we avoid talking about because there's no easy solution to it. The other thing is, of course, we all know real estate's based on the interest rate that people pay for the mortgage and the relative attractiveness of it as an investment. And in a climate where a 10-year bond is drawing 1.5 to 2% interest, then a lot of the big money rushed into rental housing because you could earn 4 or 5%, basically double.
It's essentially free money, isn't it, to make an investment, and then you receive this hefty capital gains on housing, but then you also have the rental income.
It's a great point. So then the question becomes, as for those of us looking at this as a potential investment, how do you find that seam between a neighborhood or a city that is not attractive to young people or people that make enough money to rent the place you're buying because the job market's depressed and it's not as attractive as other places? The really attractive places, which are sky high, and you cannot possibly make money buying a rental in these cities where, units are going for $500,000 or $1 million. Even at $3,000 a month or $4,000 a month rent, you're still not making money. So where can you find that? And that's, of course, the million-dollar question for small investors is, where can you go that you're not competing with Blackstone and hedge funds who are buying 10,000 houses at a time? And then we also have to look ahead and ask, what happens when interest rates go up?
This is the question that I feel that everyone is ignoring. They can't stay above board with regard to the interest rate specter. Got to buy a house now while interest rates are low. Yes, sure, you might get better terms on your 30-year ball and chain. But what happens when other folks who didn't purchase begin to realize, wait a minute, rates are going up and they might continue to go up for another 5-10 years, making real estate incredibly less affordable? This is the big question mark.
Well, Chris, you probably are better informed than I am about the global bond market. But, your listeners know by now that our economy is intimately connected to the global economy, right? And the recent increase in bond yields globally isn't more evidence of that, right? In other words, in Germany, in the U.S., it's like globally interest rates and yields seem to be rising despite the central bank's decision to keep them near zero. And so that's making people start questioning whether central banks absolutely can control this and keep interest rates, near zero forever. And the answer appears to be apparently not. In other words, the bond market might push yields higher regardless of central bank policy because the buyers of bonds are sensing higher risk. They're sensing the potential for inflation. Whatever they're perceiving, it's pushing yields higher. So the Fed can do one thing, but mortgage rates can continue to go up. Over time, as you and I know, rates and yields tend to normalize, which is another way of just saying they go back to where they used to be over the past 30, 40 years. And so, those of us who are a little older remember when a mortgage was 7 or 7.5 was a good rate. And so that would be practically double from current rates. And as you said, that would push prices down because fewer people can afford a 7% mortgage.
Just last night, I was adding about 30 references to my upcoming dissertation, and I noticed this one article, which received rave reviews within the field, pointed out exactly what you just said. They came to the conclusion that I think most of us understand intuitively, that interest rates and themes within the economy have a tendency to revert to the mean. The average day trader, knows this, anyone who's looked at a chart, but what I found interesting is that they found statistical evidence via some rather complex constructs and models to back up this idea. If rates are going to rise, that's going to put some pressure on burgeoning home buyers. And you notice the current pool, if you will, of home buyers has dried up because when the good jobs evaporate, they don't feel confident in the future. Renting looks like the better alternative. So let's talk talk about the monetary base. You know, if direct our browsers over to the St. Louis Fed, you notice there that the adjusted monetary base is at all-time record highs and, interestingly, close to an exponential increase. At the precise bottom, is this a coincidence or is QE somehow correlated with this supposed economic recovery slash miracle?
Well, I think we, you know the answer, and you've probably explained it to listeners many, many times, and clearly the answer is yes. I tend to look at this question about monetary-based overall credit, which is also soared, as part of a process I call financialization, and it's not just me, other people use the word, and what that means is when you start pursuing a bunch of economic activity that doesn't create any new goods and services in the real economy, you're not really creating value. What you're doing is you're using leverage and credit to extract profits from something that used to just be a standard business. And, you know, mortgages is a good example, right? That used to be a very dull, boring business. A bank would issue a mortgage at a low interest rate and hold it for 30 years and so on. And now it was, it's been tranched, you know, it's been sold as a security. It's had derivatives piled on top of it. And so that's why the subprime mortgage, which was industry, which was a pretty thin slice of the total mortgage business in the U.S., the collapse of that little thin slice was enough to bring down the whole global financial system because they'd loaded a tremendous amount of debt and leverage up on top of that. So that's the process of financialization, putting a bunch of extra paper money, a bunch of credit, a bunch of leverage on top of a base of actual assets, which has not grown at all.
At their own web page, one starts to, I think, notice some severe issues developing. We're starting to see money growth at exponential levels. And I think throughout time, and we look at history as our playbook, if you will, this just doesn't end well. It doesn't bode well for, our economy, for society. I mean, because all the ills that tend to stem from this type of activity. Okay, we've covered that as well. Anything that I failed to bring up, presume you're watching the equities market with a weary eye like many of us here?
Yeah, Chris, wondering what will change this sort of chop, if you will, where every time the market declines 1%, then Greece is saved, China's saved, something is saved, and then the market recovers. But it doesn't really recover in a healthy fashion. You know, that breadth is still declining, volume is very poor. So in other words, all the signs that we look for in a healthy bull market are missing, and yet price is sort of maintaining its high levels. And that's what sparks fear in those of a couple of decades of looking at markets, is when those fundamentals of, like, breadth and volume are missing, we feel that's not a healthy market, despite the apparent ability of the market to keep recovering its previous highs.
Any other markets you're following or topicality?
Shall we talk about alternatives for what investors who are just trying to either maintain their nest egg or even grow their grow their retirement fund? To me, it's almost an impossible challenge at this point in time, because everything that has been recommended by the traditional, conventional financial analysts, stocks, bonds, and real estate, they're all at bubble valuations, if you will, based, as you say, on the historical playbook. It's very difficult to make money in any of these fields, because they've already, valuations have been pushed to the moon in terms of price earnings or however you want to value the yield on your investment. And so a lot of people are looking at precious metals, which we know have been beaten up. They're limited in what they can buy, you know, where they have IRAs or they have 401ks, and they can buy a gold or precious metals fund, but they're limited in how much they can buy. So it's a very tough environment, and that's partly why I kind of wonder if it isn't an era in which it's okay to just have cash, knowing that your yield is low. But you're waiting for, you have cash in hand when opportunities do arise. And if we know anything, they do arise. From overvalued becomes undervalued.
You know, that stockpile under the mattress certainly worked out well for Americans in 2009, 10, 11. I mean, following the implosion that started arguably late 2007, 2008, picking up houses at a third, a quarter, a half, just a year or two before. So maybe deflation is something to watch for. You're certainly echoing the sentiments of many of our guests here, given that having cash on hand can prove very handy when every market implodes. You know, just last week, we saw virtually every market decline. We haven't seen this in many, many years. Charles Hughes Smith, please tell people more about Of Two Minds and give them an idea about your books you've penned and any other topicality you'd like to share.
Well, I'd welcome everyone to come to of2minds.com. Check out my latest book, which is called Get a Job, Build a Real Career, and Defy a Bewildering Economy, which is written for the new economy. In other words, not the old traditional stuff where you get a college degree and then you're going to get a great middle-class job. We know that world's gone, and so you've got to learn different kinds of skills and take a different approach, and that's kind of my topic. Solve problems, use innovation and to solve problems, because we can't just go back and think it's going to return to the good old days. It's not. That's not the way history works.
I think that's so well said, because it's a new paradigm, and we have entered, you know, this new era where folks are changing jobs every couple of years. There's very little stability in the workplace, and this idea of, you know, an entrepreneurial flair, even if you are trying to take a traditional course to employment, keeping expenses low, thinking about victory gardens, maybe having a vacation in your local area instead of a tropical resort. Not that we don't want to all go fly to Hawaii, but is that in your best interest long term? I want to encourage everyone to navigate their browsers to Of Two Minds. You'll find links on the webpage here, in our emails, and on Google search if you want to try it. We want to have you back on the show.
Thank you very much, Chris. Looking forward to it.